today, as The Guardian marks 200 years this month, we look at one amazing story from our colleague Julian Borger about how an advert in The Guardian 83 years ago saved his father's life. Julian, how did you go about finding your father's advert?
It's one of those times when I'll always remember where I was. I was in the car park of a supermarket, and there was this email from Richard Nelson, who's the archivist at The Guardian. I opened it up, and there was this classified ad, 3rd of August, 1938.
The Guardian's Julian Borger was looking at an advert placed in The Guardian 83 years earlier. It had been written by his grandparents, Leo and Erna, a Jewish couple with a young son, Robert, living in Vienna when the Nazis took control of Austria. This was their plea for help.
I seek a kind person who will educate my intelligent boy, age 11, Viennese of good family, Borger, Hinserstrasse, Vienna. And it really was like a punch to the gut. It was a very emotive moment.
And why was it like a punch to the gut?
I think because in those three lines, this was my grandparents trying to save my father's life.
This month is 200 years since The Guardian was first established in Manchester. And we will be producing a series of articles, videos, events, and of course, podcasts to explore our history and our future. For Julian, a part of that history is deeply personal. But when he began looking into this, he realised that his grandparents' advert was not a one-off. In fact, dozens of Guardian readers responded to calls for help from Jewish families based in Vienna at the outbreak of the Second World War. Here is what he discovered. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the remarkable story of how Jewish parents used newspaper adverts to save their children's lives. Julian, take me back to before 1938. What do you know of your grandparents' life back then?
The family ran a shop in a district of Vienna selling musical instruments and radios. My father was their only child. There are lots of photos of summer holidays at the Baden, which is a spa resort near Vienna, and standing proudly outside the shop, which was called Radio Borger. They're obviously very proud of this business they've been able to establish.
Tell me, by 1938, what was happening politically in Vienna?
In March, the Anschluss happened, which was the annexation of Austria by Nazi Germany.
In Vienna, city of song and music known around the world, 500,000 pack the streets while buildings are covered with the symbols of the German Reich. With six tanks leading a two-mile-long procession of Reich Army and stormtroopers, and with German bombers patrolling the skies, Adolf Hitler, modern Caesar, enters the land of his birth in his modern chariot of triumph.
And very quickly after that, life for the Jews in Vienna began to change step by step. The first thing that happened was in Nuremberg, racial laws were brought in that limited their rights. And then Jews were called in to the local Gestapo headquarters to register. And when they did, they were made to do something humiliating, usually get down on their hands and knees and wash the pavement. And as they did, a lot of people came out of the woodwork, a lot of Nazi sympathizers, and they're often beaten up and roughed up. My grandfather was taken away, held at the Gestapo headquarters for a day, released, then picked up again. Every day, every week, the pressure and the sense of danger, the sense of dread was stepped up notch by notch.
Do you know how it was for your grandparents? Do you know what they felt at the time?
They clearly, fairly early on, realised they at least had to get my father out. It is interesting to look back at some of the other family stories and the reluctance of people to give up everything that they'd lived for, everything they'd built up in terms of their home, their businesses, their life. And so a lot of people persuaded themselves that this won't last. The Nazis don't really belong here. It's just a passing phase. And they waited too long.
Do you think they realised what was coming?
I'm really not sure, because neither my father or my grandparents talked much at all about that period. So I don't really have that insight into how bad they thought it was going to be. But talking to others and reading other memoirs, most Viennese Jews thought that bad things were going to happen. I don't think they could have conceived then of how bad it was going to be, that it was about mass extermination and not just oppression.
So if by then your grandparents knew that at the very least they had to get their son out, what were their options in order to try to escape?
The only real option for getting a child out was through tuition, if he was a foreign student. And so you had to find someone or an institution that would say, we will take care of the education of this child. They would clear that with the Home Office, and then they would get a document from Britain which could be presented to the Nazi authorities in Vienna. But although the Nazis wanted the Jews out, they at the same time made it incredibly hard to get that exit visa.
And what other things were people doing to try to escape?
Well, people were aware that the only way they could get a visa into the UK as adults was as domestic servants. At the time, there was a shortage of domestics in Britain. And so a lot of them took classes in doing these household things, sewing, looking after children, a chauffeur, any skill that they could claim, they laid it out there in these three-line resumes.
And so people placed these ads. Why were so many choosing The Guardian?
The Guardian was singled out because it was seen at the time to be sympathetic and alert to the plight of the Jews in Germany and Central Europe. And just before the turn of Viennese Jews to flee, there were appeals in The Guardian to help Basque children during the Spanish Civil War. So it had a record for helping refugees.
And what do we know about the coverage at the time? How much did the public in the UK understand what was happening to Jewish people before the war?
Readers at the Manchester Guardian had as good a grasp as any of what was going on inside Germany, and in particular inside Vienna, because the paper's correspondent in Vienna, a guy called Marcel Fodor, who was known as Mike, was really at that time the doyen of the foreign correspondents in Vienna and covered the rise of the Nazis and what was being done to the Jews in some detail and with compassion and sympathy, to the extent that when the Nazis arrived in Vienna, Fodor had to make a run for it with his family in the night across the border into Czechoslovakia.
Okay, so that's the context of the time, and clearly people were desperate. Your grandparents placed this advert in The Guardian looking for somebody to take their son to safety. Tell me what happened next.
A couple of Welsh school teachers, Nance and Reg Bingley, responded to the advert. They were Guardian reading Fabian socialists living in Carnarvon and had already taken in Welsh orphans into their home and had a history of fostering children. And they took my father in as well and promised to educate my father and wrote letters to that effect and got the paperwork done through the Home Office in London.
How did your dad get there?
He was relatively lucky. He travelled out by train with my grandmother because my grandmother has separately been able to get a visa as a maid. But you couldn't, in most cases, have any children. So on my grandmother's passport, there's a line through the section that would say if you had any children.
What do you know about that train journey and when your father was separated from his mother?
One of the anecdotes handed down in the family is from the point where it crossed out of the Reich into the Netherlands. The people that they were sharing their carriage with got up, and they were clearly Nazi officials. They had the lapel pin. And when they got up to leave the carriage, they gave the Heil Hitler salute. Now, neither my father nor my grandmother were allowed to, nor had obviously any willingness to return that salute. And so it was only at that moment that these Nazis who shared the carriage with them realized that they'd been Jews. And as my father told it, their faces fell when that realization dawned. That was their last moment in the Reich, and then they crossed over. And then it was a question of getting to the Hook of Holland, and then it was a ferry ride over to Harwich.
And how old was your father?
He was 11 at the time.
So that was him with his mother. Where was his father?
They had to leave my grandfather back in Vienna in my grandparents' advert, also in the Manchester Guardian, this one in the 10th of October, 38, it says, Viennese couple of old Vienna citizens' family, versatile, willing workers, seek post as servants, couple or separately. And so what happened is a visa came up for my grandmother, but not for my grandfather.
Do you have a sense of how hard it was for them to leave him?
That moment was never described to me because so much of this was taboo. It really wasn't a subject that was talked about in our family. And the trauma of that moment of separation was not mentioned. But I can imagine that they separated knowing that they might not see each other again.
You mentioned the Welsh couple, the Bingleys, who took your father in. What was his life like with them?
My father was really lucky. The Bingleys were wonderful people, really kind. Reg Bingley stayed at home and taught my father first Welsh and then English until he was ready to go to school. But from what Nance told me of my father when he was young, he arrived really traumatized. They had to take the whistle off the kettle because it reminded him of the SA, the brown shirts going around, rounding people up. And then when a family friend thought he was being nice and said, "Look, come for a walk," my father fainted because he was conditioned to believe that he was being taken out to be killed. But he was extremely lucky in the foster parents that took care of him in the Bingleys, because from reading about other experiences, it wasn't always that way. Other refugee kids had a much rougher time.
Your grandparents' advert wasn't the only one in the Manchester Guardian trying to get kids or even adults out of Vienna, was it?
I immediately realised there were more, because in this section of the paper that was sent with my dad's classified, there were ads above and below. And so I got the password into the archives and then started to look in the classifieds, particularly under tuition, where most of the children were, and realised there were this extraordinary clamour of parents trying to save their children by extolling their virtues. He's a good child from a good family. She's very clever, good at music, good at all these things. It was really overwhelming to see how many there were. And strikingly, almost all of them were from Vienna.
Were you able to work out exactly how many?
I counted about 60 children and hundreds altogether, including adults.
And you decided to work out what happened to the other children. How did you go about that?
So usually what you would have is simply, as in the case of my dad, just a family name and an age. And then there's this website called Jewish Gen where you can get basic data. And if I looked under Vienna, usually with that name, there would be two or three children born in about the right year. And if you got that, that gave you a full name and a date of birth. And then I could go back to these other websites in Britain, the US, like Find My Past and Ancestry, enter in the full name and a date of birth. And this was really the kind of moment of truth for each one I was trying to locate. If they had survived, they left a trace in the British archives, if only an enemy alien card, which was made out for anyone coming from Nazi-occupied Europe. And so it was really an emotional moment. You'd find out if someone had survived or not, whether they'd made it to Britain. And if they hadn't, if there was no sign, then I would go back to this website, Jewish Gen, which also listed deportations, and find out if and when they'd been deported to the camps. So doing that again and again, you became kind of emotionally invested in whether this child, you've just read their advert, lived or died.
That's absolutely extraordinary. You must have read some heartbreaking stories and some pretty joyful ones.
Yes, absolutely. And the families that left it too late are really heartbreaking stories. But glad to say that almost all of the children who were advertised in the Manchester Guardian made it out. There was some trace of them arriving in Britain and often going off to the US after that. I think in Vienna, if you were aware enough and determined enough to be putting in these adverts, your child most likely was going to get out because you had found the right way to get out.
Were you able to speak to any of the actual children who travelled to the UK?
I was about 3 weeks too late for the last surviving child of the classified ads. It was someone who emigrated to Israel after being in Britain for a few years. And according to the online seemed to still be alive. There was no notice of his death. And so my hopes really up that I'd found the last survivor, and then got his son on his phone and said, "You're too late. He died 3 weeks ago and had survived until this year."
Wow. But you were able to speak to their children, presumably. When you reached out to them, had they seen the Guardian adverts before?
Most hadn't and were absolutely shocked to see it. One woman, Sandra Garfinkel, who I called in New York, who had never seen it before, was absolutely shocked. And she said, "If you knew me, you'd know I'm very rarely silent. But right now, I am just stunned into silence." There was one family who had, the granddaughter of the survivor, had dug it out from the Manchester Guardian archives. And those were the children of Gertrude Batcher, whose advert was put in the 29th of July, 38. The advert said, "A Jewish merchant, Vienna, begs Jewish family in Great Britain to receive his only daughter, age 14, into their house. She is well-mannered, able to help in any household work, speaks German, French, and a little English, comma, piano."
Tell me how Julian got in touch with you.
Well, it was actually so exciting because suddenly we get a phone call. Actually, my husband got a phone call and he's not so good in English. So he said, "Oh, I don't know, someone is talking to me in English." And he passed the phone over to me. And it took me a few seconds to realize who I'm talking to. And Julian was talking about my mother, and he knew everything about her, her name and her Israeli name. And he knew about the advertisement in the Manchester Guardian.
So, Ruthie Danny, I know that in her later life, and once you were grown up, your mother, Gertrude, who later changed her name to Yehudit when she moved to Israel, wrote a diary called Because You Wanted to Know. And in it, she told you about her past. But what had you known while you were growing up?
We knew only specific headlines, that she had a very happy childhood. She grew up as the only child in a very wealthy family. Her father was a very honorable Austrian citizen and never got deep into the feelings. Actually, we went to see the house. It's still there in Vienna, so we know what she was talking about.
We could actually open the book that she wrote and walk with the book through the house. This was a chilling, very emotional situation for us. We could imagine our mother and her parents actually living in the place.
And you know what the family were thinking in the late 30s as that threat from the Nazis became more clear?
The family decided to start looking for a way to go out of Austria. For example, I know my grandfather took a course of a butler, and my grandmother, she took a course of sewing ties and studying how to sew clothes because they were looking for a way to earn money when they are out of Austria. And when they realized that they have a way to save their child, they said, "Okay, first we save her, then we try to save ourselves." And that's how they came to the idea of sending her to England and to advertise at the Manchester Guardian.
Clearly, they tried everything they could to get out as a family. When they realized that their only choice was to get their daughter out, and they placed that ad, how do you think they felt?
"Let me read you a passage from my mother's memoir. I hope never to know such desperation as prompted them to decide to part with me and send me away alone. The countless Jewish parents who did this belong undoubtedly among the unsung heroes of our history. True, later, during bouts of misery and despair, at my aloneness, I sometimes blamed them and wished I had shared their fate as the price of being together. But, of course, never in their blackest nightmares did they envisage the parting to be final. All they wanted was to save their most precious possession."
When you read that, how do you feel?
Oh, you know, I feel like my heart is tearing into pieces, really. How can parents make such a decision? They must be real desperate, really. And she was their only daughter. I keep on thinking of my grandmother and grandfather, and I feel that they really went through a terrible time.
Within this memoir, your mother describes leaving her parents at the train station. Can you tell me about that?
I imagine that this was both excitement, you know, a young girl going on a trip, a new world, and so on and so forth. But combined with that, also fear from the unknown and probably some realization, because the war was imminent, that maybe they may not meet again. And I read from her memoir, and then, while agonizedly waiting for the whistle to blow and the passengers to board and the train to leave, there on the platform, my mother pronounced one of her prophecies. On pointing to a little old woman with white hair, she said, "That's what I'll look like and how old I'll be before I'll see you again." How I always wished she had been right. This is where I feel tears coming to my eyes.
Me too. What was her life like in England? What do you know?
Well, she went through a very hard time. First of all, she didn't know a word in English. So she used to walk around with a very heavy dictionary. She had to do all kind of domestic works in the house, which she wasn't used doing at all. And she wanted very much to continue school, but she wasn't allowed to. She was 14, so it was the age of not having to study any longer. And she was describing her crying into the pillow during the night, trying not to show it in the morning. The family has two children, and she didn't get along with them so good. She had very hard time. Then she moved to another family, and then to another family. And after almost a year, she found at last a Jewish family who really hugged her and invited her to live with them, and it was in Bradford, the Kaner family. And there she actually found the place to live for the whole years of the war.
And was she in touch with her parents?
Yes. They promised her to write a letter every day, and they did it. And she also wrote to them. And the post went very fast, and we have all the letters that they sent her, how they tried to find a way to go out of Austria. And on one letter, her father writes, "We can get a visa to the United States in a year." And they kept on telling her what they are doing every day, and they're waiting for her letters and encouraging her to be strong and describing how they put her letters under their pillow when they go to sleep. So through the letters, we could get the sense of what they went through during that time. After 3 years, the letters stopped.
Danny, when did your mother find out what had happened to her parents?
So she never told us, but in the memoirs, I can read the following brief piece. And then one day, a communication arrived from the Red Cross. It held a short list of names and places and approximate dates of death of my family or those that were then traceable. I have no recollection at all of opening that letter or of what it looked like or where it disappeared to. All I have is a penciled copy of this list on a scrap of paper in my handwriting, buried deep among other documents and looked at only once every 10 years or so. I believe that she got the letter only after the war. So presumably in 1945, that is about 6 or 7 years after she left them.
Ruthie, let me ask you, did your mother tell you how she felt when she found out that her parents had died?
She told me that she had a breakdown because she realized that she was an orphan for many years and she just didn't know. And she went into bed crying for days and days and couldn't stand on her feet. So her friends, they took her to the doctor and he was not emotional at all. And he said, now you have to gather yourself together, go back to work, go back to life. You are not the only one in that situation.
Oh, God.
He didn't pity her at all. He just told her, you pull yourself together and back to life. And that's what she did. And never, I think, be able to talk about that to anybody anymore. Even to us, you know, she didn't want us to be unhappy.
Many, many, many of the families of survivors of the Holocaust, and to a certain degree, both our parents are somehow some type of survivors of that period, actually never spoke about their past to their children. Never. And presumably this was A, to protect, quote unquote, the children from learning about the horrors, and possibly also to protect themselves from the emotional breakdown when they might eventually tell their stories. Years later, my son, when he was 13 years old, he had an assignment from school to write about the history of the family. And since at that time, the memoirs of our mother was already available, he wanted to ask our father about it. And our father was a reserved person. And our son managed to start to record him. 5 minutes into the recording, our father collapsed in tears and never wanted to talk about that period again. We know very little about what our father was, or who was also on the Kindertransport, experienced from 1938 roughly to 1948. Very little. He was also in the UK. And so you would, as a child, Ruth and I, we simply would not ask.
I know your mother met your father in the UK and then they moved to Israel together, which is where you were both brought up. What was life like for her? What was she like as a mother? Did she find happiness?
Well, I always felt being a little different from the surrounding because not having grandmother and grandfather, and because all my mother and father were very protective. I remember they were terrified when one of us had to fly to another country because of the trauma for not being able to meet again. It was always in the back of our mind what they went through. And although they really tried hard not to put all that agony on us, children can feel things between the words.
What about you, Danny?
I have a different perspective, possibly because A, I was the eldest, and B, possibly because I'm a boy, and because of personality differences. I never felt that agony or memories put any dark shadow on our daily life. I never felt anything like that. On the contrary, if they did feel something like that, they hid it, at least from me, maybe not from Ruthie, so well that life for me was what I would assume is I felt it very, very normal. And they were a happy couple and we were a happy family. I never felt anything that I can relate back to what they have experienced. But this is possibly because I'm much less emotional than mother and certainly than Ruthie. So I don't know.
I know that she always, always missed her life in Vienna, and she longed to the places in the mountains where they went to vacations. And it took her 50 years since she could go back to Austria.
Yeah.
She went back.
She went back, and they went to the house where she lived, but her feet didn't take her up to knock on the door. She just couldn't. And she just stood there and she took a photograph of her and my father in front of the house. And I know that she would be happy to stay there if she could for life. But life came different to her, to them. And I know that the big family that they made in Israel was like a revenge on the Nazis for what they did to her family.
Yeah, you should realize that by now they had 7 grandchildren from us, 4 from Ruti and 3 from my wife and me. And now Ruti herself has 11 grandchildren. And I have 5 grandchildren. And our parents knew some of the eldest among the grandchildren. And they were extremely proud. Like Ruti said, this was, in a way, revenge for them all. I think that they felt that, in a way, they fulfilled some sort of a destiny by having such a large family, I believe.
I think that's one of the nicest things I've ever heard. Heartbreaking, but beautiful. Let me just ask you both finally. All of this happened because of that tiny advert that they posted in a newspaper that provided a passage for your mother to get out of Vienna. And it happened because of a family who responded to that advert. Just finally, what are your thoughts about that when you think about that?
Yes, this little advert made her destiny to be able to save her life and continue living, first of all, 10 years in the UK and then in Israel, having a big family. That was her fate.
When I look at the ad, I view it as a life buoy without which our mother would not have survived. And in fact, this is a key point in the history of our family without which we would not be talking to each other.
Coming up, what happened next for Julian's father? Julian, learning about these stories, did you find common threads with your own?
Yes, absolutely. I think one is this sense of a burden that these children had come out with, either from the trauma of everything that they'd known as children being ripped apart or having left behind relatives who died. And I think one lesson I had from doing this is that very often stays for a lifetime and is handed down from generation to generation. Obviously, that casts a light on what refugees today from Syria and elsewhere are going through.
And one thing that must have been incredibly traumatic was leaving your grandfather behind. Did he manage to escape Vienna?
Yes, he did. Once my grandmother and father were in the UK, they were able to organise to get him a visa. He ended up working for a factory set up by German refugees making bras and corsets. And it started off in London and then moved up to Shrewsbury because of the Blitz. And that's where my grandfather spent the rest of his life as a cutter in a bra factory in Shrewsbury.
And what about other relatives? Did anyone survive and return to Vienna?
Yes, I had one great aunt called Malvina, and we knew her as Malchi, who had been the assistant to the head of the local Communist Party when the Anschluss happened. And so they immediately got out of Austria, went to Paris, and then she fled to the south of France and was sheltered in a convent for the rest of the war. But then when the war ended, she got out, went back home, and realized that both her husband and her son had been killed, and stayed on in Vienna. But really, it was a question of existing rather than living. She stayed in this tiny flat, really just living in the shadow of the war and living for our occasional visits. When I was based in Central Europe, I was able to go more often and each time go to this awful Chinese restaurant round the corner. And she would always say how she felt that the Viennese basically hadn't changed, hadn't really shown remorse.
Your father was really young when he went. Was he reunited with his parents?
He was reunited with them, but he never lived with them again, in part because that was the rules. He had a student visa, and my grandparents had visas that didn't allow them to live with their children. And so through his teens, until he left for university, he lived in Carnarvon and obviously would go and visit, but his life was with the Bingleys. And I think that my grandparents thought that is what is going to give him the best chance in Britain if he grows up in an English-speaking, a British family. But it must have been incredibly hard for them.
I can't even imagine what it must have been like to have escaped and then have been unable to be together. What was your father's life like in the years and then decades that followed?
He was very successful as a student. He went on to become a psychologist, but clearly looking back, always had this shadow hanging over him. And he ended up taking his own life in 1983. And it was my job to ring Nance Bingley and to tell her this news. And her first response was, "This is the Nazi's latest victim." I mean, it's a way that I'd never thought about it because he'd had all sorts of career problems and kind of made a mess of his private life. And so I'd always seen it through that prism. But she'd seen him as an 11-year-old boy who'd arrived totally traumatized. And for her, you know, that boy was always within him and that shadow always remained.
How old were you in 1983?
I was 22.
That must have been incredibly hard.
Yes, absolutely.
Julian, you've been working at The Guardian since the 1990s, a newspaper that you now know had this amazing role to play in your family's past. How do you think your father might have felt about you working here?
You know, he had the kind of traditional refugees' hopes for their children that they get a proper profession like being a doctor or a lawyer. But I would like to think that he would appreciate me working for The Guardian because it was treated with a certain degree of reverence in our house. His father was a Social Democrat. He was a Social Democrat. And I would like to think that he would be proud of me working for The Guardian.
Julian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Julian Borger. And joining us from Israel, Ruthie Alkana and Danny Siegel. A huge thanks to all of them. Julian has written an amazing piece about all of this. Do read it at theguardian.com. It's all part of our 200-year celebrations. I hope you managed to buy The Guardian yesterday and as part of it, receive the first ever copy of the Manchester Guardian back on May the 5th, 1821. To mark 200 years, we are, of course, celebrating our past, but also thinking about the future. The focus is on The Guardian as a work in progress since its birth in Manchester. There have been so many powerful investigations, but there is so much more we want to do and conversations we want to have about how to make things better. As part of the anniversary, there are a series of articles, videos, podcasts like this one, and events such as our free Guardian at 200 Made in Manchester event on May the 11th. Do check it all out at theguardian.com/200. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Sami El Enani. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.